Over the past few years, Debbie Heath has come into our studio many times to discuss different books, audio books, that we thought might be of interest to our listeners. I'm glad to say that she's come up with another idea. It's an author we've looked at before, but it's a book that I'd never heard of. So, Debbie, tell us all about it. What is it this time?
This time, I have picked for you one of Daphne du Maurier's lesser-known novels. It's called The Scapegoat, and it was written in 1959. Unusually for du Maurier, it's not set in Cornwall, but in France. Like a lot of her other books, it has dark themes, there's a lot of suspense, and there is a male narrator, which is something she seems to use quite a lot. There is also a slightly open end, but we won't be giving any of that away. It is like a lot of her books, but also has a few subtle differences. And the premise of the story is that a young man bumps into his doppelganger in France and they end up swapping lives for a short time.
Let's be sure that everybody's happy with this term doppelganger, because the nearest you can get to it is almost a reflection in a mirror. It's you looking back at yourself. It's not a split personality.
No.
It means it's a reflection of yourself and you see yourself. And so critically, he turns around and sees somebody that he looks exactly like him.
Yeah.
And that's the essence. That's the beginnings of it. She's written a lot of stuff, obviously, and you named a few of them. I was thinking of some of the short stories as well. The Birds is very famous because of the Hitchcock film. But also Don't Look Now. And there's almost a sense that he thinks he's seen his child all the way through. He's running after his child who drowned, but he sees this little figure in a red coat that was just like his child. And that's almost a doppelganger, but it's not quite. It's an imagined double, as it were.
The Birds is probably her most famous book, but that is probably because of the Hitchcock adaptation. And they're subtly different, actually. Since I read Rebecca as a young woman, I have enjoyed Daphne du Maurier's works. She was a very interesting person. So shall we listen to the first extract where our hero John discovers his doppelganger for the first time?
Someone jolted at my elbow as I drank. It's Roger de Montpardon. And as I moved to give him space, he turned and stared at me and I at him, and I realised, with a strange sense of shock and fear and nausea all combined, that his face and voice were known to me too well. I was looking at myself. We did not speak. We went on staring at one another. I'd heard of these things happening, people who meet casually and turn out to be long-lost cousins or twins parted at birth. And the idea is amusing, or perhaps fraught with tragedy, like the man in the Iron Mask. This was not funny, nor was it tragic. The resemblance made me slightly sick, reminding me of moments when, passing a shop window, I'd suddenly seen my own reflection. And the man in the mirror had been a grotesque caricature of what, conceitedly, I had believed myself to be. Such incidents left me chastened, sore, with ego deflated, but they never gave me a chill down the spine as this encounter did, nor the desire to turn and run. He was the first to break the silence. You don't happen to be the devil, by any chance? I might ask you the same question, I replied.
It's interesting, even in the use of that word devil there, there's a sort of hinting at something almost satanic in this. And she's very good at that, because she does set, as you said, we Don't Look Now, she sets up situations that you never really forget, because that's quite a frightening film, very disturbing, and much of her work can be disturbing, although she was often called a romantic novelist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's fair. Rebecca is sort of a romantic novel, but I think it's too sinister. I mean, My Cousin Rachel, that's another that seems to be a romantic novel, but it's a very, very chilling tale. And that has translated very well into a film. And I think that's because she was brought up in a theatrical family. She's got a wonderful ear for dialogue and very, very good at establishing characters. And I found that at the beginning of this book, I was quite sceptical. Oh, for goodness sake, no one is ever going to find their doppelganger. This is ridiculous. And certainly as the plot unravels at the beginning, I just thought, no, I'm not following this at all. But soon she's just cast a spell, and she's done that because of her wonderful characterisation. So what happens next is that Jean, French Jean, funnily enough, they both have the same name, gets him drunk. And when John, English John, wakes up in the morning, he is in French John's clothes and his chauffeur is waiting to take him to the country. And this has come about because the previous night when they were getting drunk, they were both bemoaning their lives. French John has too much on his plate and English John doesn't have enough. He's feeling a bit depressed. So here we are. He's called his bluff and now he's been thrust into a very complicated life.
And it is a complicated life because although you might want to talk about the journey going there in a second, when he gets to where he's going, which is the house of Le Comte, the Count, Count de Jean. So he's a minor aristocrat with a chateau in the country and various other things. When he gets there, he finds he's actually in the family from hell. He's got a lot of problems there. But let's go back because you mentioned something before when we were talking about the drive. I mean, that was the moment where he could have said to the chauffeur, actually, I'm not who you think I am.
Well, I think he does say that quite early on, right at the beginning when the chauffeur comes to the hotel. Look, you've made a mistake. These are not my clothes. They're someone else's clothes. And it sounds like the chauffeur's heard this before. You know, very well, sir, come with me. But it must be very difficult to drive to your own house when you don't know where it is. Yeah, the early parts of the book, I find it hilarious. He has to go to his bedroom, doesn't know where it is wandering around the corridors, opening doors, hopefully. And he meets his new family. And at first, he isn't sure who is his wife and finds out that he has a daughter. One of my favourite scenes is when he has to give out presents to his family. French John has got these in Paris, but English John has no idea what's inside. He's only got initials to go by and accidentally gives some people the wrong present. And it's an absolutely hilarious scene over the breakfast table.
In which he manages to upset just about everybody.
Because the
present they're getting is either something that shouldn't be said in public. Jean, the Frenchman, has been having an affair with his brother's wife.
Exactly. He's a complete rogue. Let's say he has not just been having an affair with his brother's wife. He's a cad, French John. And our English John is very straightforward, very honest, and soon comes to realise what a terrible person his French counterpart is. And basically, he tries to make amends throughout this whole novel.
You rightly said, you don't know where he's looking in this house, but he finally gets his room. He finds he's got a wife.
Yes. Yes.
Not very well, she's in bed. He finds he's got a mother. She's not very well either.
No.
He's got a brother. He's not very happy. And he's got a daughter.
Yes, and what a wonderful character this daughter is. I love the relationship between him and the daughter. And our next extract is another one of my favourites. It's where he has a good old chat with the daughter for the first time since coming back. And she's a little bit suspicious, isn't she? Let's listen.
To try and grasp the significance of this new and unexpected complication of a daughter, and then endeavouring to hold my ground, I said, I thought you were supposed to have a fever. I did this morning, she said, but when my aunt Blanche looked at the thermometer this evening, it was only just above normal. Since I stood by the window, it has probably shot up again. Sit down. She patted the bed beside her. Why didn't you come to see me the instant you got back, she asked. Her manner was imperious, as if she was accustomed to giving orders. I did not answer. Joker, she said lightly, and then she put out her hand and seized mine and kissed it. Have you had your nails manicured? No. They're a different shape, and your hands are cleaner. I suppose that is what Paris does for men. Also, you have a different smell. What sort of smell? She wrinkled her nose. Like a doctor, she said, or a priest or a stranger who comes to tea. I'm sorry. I stared at her nonplussed. It will pass off. It is evident you have been moving in exalted circles.
And I think there's another moment when the dog, which would have been Jean's dog,
yes,
comes out. And
is Caesar the dog.
Because the dogs are going to know the smell, yeah, the movement, the tone of voice, everything. And this dog is not sure at all.
No.
Gets the clothes, but doesn't get the feel this is the same person.
A wife would know the touch of her husband, but she's just impressed, I think, that he's become a little bit more sensitive. So, yeah, at this point, I was still feeling a little bit sceptical, but it really wasn't long before I was completely spellbound by this book.
We're talking about the people, and she's very good. Daphne du Maurier is extremely good at creating characters and at creating the flow of the narrative. I mean, once you've got through those first moments thinking, I'm not sure about this, is this going to work? I don't know. Then you get engrossed in it. Because he gets very close to what he tries to say. I am not the person you think I am. And then he sort of thinks, well, actually, let's stay with it. And he does stay with it. And he goes through these encounters with the different members of his family. And of course, there's more to it than that, because it's not just a house and a family, but there's a business.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is an interesting choice of businesses, because in fact, it relates, but goes back to her family.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So it's a glass refinery. And I did a bit of delving, and I found out that the French side of the Dumouriez family, if you went back enough, were from this part of France, and they did have a glassworks of their own. So I assume that's why Daphne Dumouriez chose it, because it's very sensible to write about what you know about. So, yeah, there's not only trouble at home to deal with, but trouble away from home, the family business. And it becomes apparent to him that something has gone awry, and French John's visit to Paris was all about fixing that problem. And he has no idea whether he's fixed it or not. All he can do at this stage is bluff his way through.
Oh, mon dieu, said Paul in exasperation, as if my cautious hedging question was the ultimate straw, the final insult to patience too long shown. There's only one issue, isn't there? Do we or do we not close down? Somebody, was it the mother, had said something about contract? The visit to Paris hinged on a Carvere contract. Jean de Gouet was expecting to bring it back with him. Very well, then, they should have it. If you mean, did I succeed in getting Carvere to renew the contract, the answer is yes, I said. Both men stared at me, astounded. Jacques burst out with a bravo, but Paul interrupted. On what terms? What stipulations? Our terms, I said. They made no stipulations. You don't mean to tell me they're willing to take our stuff on precisely the same conditions as before, in spite of the lower quotations they're getting from other firms? I persuaded them to do so. How many discussions did you have?
Several.
But what's the explanation? Why all those letters? Were they bluffing, trying to make us lower our figure, or what?
I couldn't tell you.
And then you came away completely satisfied, and we carry on a further period of 6 months?
That's about it.
He's got a big problem. He digs himself a hole. He does the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Yes.
And then he's got to sort it out.
Yes. We know that Jean went to Paris to get some, raise some funds to keep this factory moving forward. He, of course, poor John, our hero, our narrator, doesn't know any of that background. He's having to dig and delve. It's clearly a much more complicated situation than he thought.
Yeah, he's having to wing it all the way through. English John wants to please. So he's told the family what he thought they wanted to hear, that he'd solved the problem in Paris. In fact, French John had not solved the problem. So now English John has to dig himself out of that hole. And that goes on for quite a lot of the book. So we won't give away the outcome of that. But the poor man has got to deal with problems with his family and with his business. And it turns out that these two are very intertwined.
It's difficult because we don't want to give anything away. And so we keep sort of hedging around the things. And this is always the same problem we have, because it is a story which evolves. And
yes,
you get more and more information coming out. It's like unwrapping a parcel.
It is.
More and more comes on. So let's maybe shift away from the story for a moment and look at the themes within
it.
Yeah,
let's do that. I feel there are two main themes, and we've touched on one already. And that is the sense of self, whether that's a doppelganger or whatever. Daphne Dumouriez had a very unusual personality. She had the loving mother side, which she let a lot of people see. That was her public persona. And then she had what she told her biographer was a very male energy. So this was the side of her that was the lover, the writer, the businesswoman, and a very driving force. Now, there has been speculation that she was bisexual. There is some information that suggests she at least had a relationship with Gertrude Lawrence, who was a great pal of Noel Coward's, actress and general performer, and a few other relationships. We don't know that for sure. We do know that she seemed to be ashamed of that side of her. We also know that she was a tomboy. Now, of course, these days, no one cares about any of that. We are very happy to label ourselves in any way, and quite rightly so. But in those days, it would have been very shameful to be anything other than heterosexual, wouldn't it? She was riddled with self-doubt. She didn't really understand perhaps her own personality. And I think that really comes through in a lot of her books, actually, but particularly in this one.
One of the things that struck me, I was thinking about this, and she says at one stage that it's the male side of her which drives her writing forward. I'm not quoting words, but that's more or less what she says. And I was then thinking back, yes, because it's not that long before here that George Eliot, a woman, was writing under a man's name. That's 19th century.
Mm.
And then, it's, you know, there are lots of women writers who have never been heard of or known because they were never published, because
that's
women
right.
didn't get published. They weren't, you know, there's a real struggle. And you go through that whole stage. She's a sort of halfway. She's inherited that fear of, it's only men that write novels, or it's only men that write. And yet now we're in the 21st century. Well, not only can anybody be whatever identity, self-identity is a choice, if you like, if I put it that way.
Yeah.
But also, the women who write nowadays, wouldn't even think about it.
No, I mean, poor thing. She must have had a terrible battle. I mean, I suppose this is why most of her narrators are male. I don't know if she actually consciously made that choice or not. But
it's
I'm
in
sure.
the site, it's there in the background.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is.
And of course, he married a very English, very Edwardian sort of English dominant personality. And that would that would have been her childhood in that as well. So men were the rulers. I was watching Howard's End the other day, and of course, it's exactly very similar.
That's right.
That period of time where the men said, don't worry your little head about this. Remember those days?
Well, I'm very glad I don't live in them.
What was the second theme you think?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I think the other one, if I was to narrow it down, would be the theme of escape. I'm sure most people have idly wondered if they have a doppelganger. But I'm sure most people have also wondered, on a bad day in the office, if I had the chance to escape from this monotonous life, would I do it? And most of the time, I'm sure it would be a no, because you'd have to escape forever. If you knew that you could escape the monotony of your life for a day or a week, would you do it? Well, I think a lot more people would. So in this case, French Jean is given that opportunity on a plate. He's fed up of all his family commitments, his business problems. He has got this chance to escape it, but he's the one in the driving seat. Again, we mustn't give too much away, but he knows that at any point he can get his identity back.
Do you think that English John has the same feeling that he can go back to where he was?
No, I don't think he does. He is not holding the reins in this situation at all, is he? There is that definite point where he does make the choice to stop protesting and he decides to go with it. But I don't think you can say that he's made the choice to be in that situation. He chooses to make the best of the situation, which is different. And he doesn't know when it's going to end. He might always be in that situation, you know.
And things are revealed to him so progressively, he almost can't catch up. Because as fast as he thinks he's understood the situation, the situation develops. He gets more about the past that makes it complicated for him.
Yeah.
But he's in it up to his neck.
He is. And I suppose what the book is saying is that, well, the grass always seems greener in another field, but the journey to get to it can be difficult, and it doesn't mean that it's going to end up happily ever after. Who knows? But yeah, I think escape is a theme that is prevalent all the way through. It's a fascinating book. If you can suspend your disbelief just at the beginning, I think you will reap the rewards, because I was really sad when this book was over, actually. I read it very quickly. I had a long wait at Moorfields Eye Hospital. And I got through about half of it, and it was absolutely marvellous. It's an exciting book, it's a dark book, and it's one that makes you think a bit afterwards, and I immediately recommended it to my husband. I know you gave it to your wife, I've lent it to my mum. It's just one of those books, it's an interesting concept, and I think she pulls it off. I don't think everyone could, but I think she does.
No, I agree. Thank you very much, Debbie.